The Rise and Fall of Alexandria, Birthplace of the Modern Mind, by Justin Pollard and Howard Reed. Narrated by Simon Vance. Copyright 2006, Justin Pollard and Howard Reed. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Justin Pollard and Howard Reed and Viking, and was produced in the year 2006 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Preface. Flotsam. Antiquities are history defaced, or some remnants of history which have casually escaped the shipwreck of time. Francis Bacon. The Advancement of Learning. On most days in the summer of A.D. 1295, an Eastern Orthodox monk called Maximus Planudes could have been found in the great market of Constantinople, making his way past the spice sellers and the silk traders to the dusty undercrofts where the book merchants piled their own wares in tottering stacks of parchment. Here were codices and manuscripts in Arabic, Syriac, Greek, and Latin, some newly completed, some old, holy books for all religions, practical treatises, histories, and chronologies. Here, too, were books still waiting to be written, fresh blank sheets and old volumes that had been scrubbed clean of whatever they once held, ready for a new text. Walking along the waterfront to the great market, Maximus Planudes might have been reminded of the description in Strabo of Alexandria in the 1st century AD, which he excitedly called the greatest emporium in the whole world. Constantinople, despite the sack of 1204, had since taken on that mantle, which was why this diminutive monk was spending each day of a hot summer there, searching through piles of books and manuscripts. The book dealers must have taken careful note of this unusual creature in their midst. Monks swarmed through the city, but their interest in books was invariably limited to medieval Greek religious works, the biblical glosses and commentaries, the credulous hagiographies, the missals, psalters, and breviaries, whose attraction was as much in the artistic illumination of their pages as in the illuminating quality of their text. But Planudes was after something else. He spent his hours poring over the dreariest-looking texts, from faded Latin fragments to terse Arabic treatises. Then one day, sometime that summer, he found it. It certainly wasn't much to look at, but there in his hands was a fragment from the wreckage, a rare treasure, finally washed up on a distant shore. He had found Claudius Ptolemy's great lost work on geography, Geographia, written in ancient Alexandria, stored for centuries in her library, and believed, at least in the West, to have perished there. Rumours had been circulating in Europe that a copy had been seen in Arabic translation, just as Ptolemy's other great work was already known to Arabic scholars as the greatest, or, in their language, Almagest. Now, here was its companion. The rumours were true. The survival of this masterful text was a small miracle in itself. The original copies of the Geographia had been deposited in the library of Alexandria by Claudius Ptolemy himself, and there they had remained in constant use for centuries. It appears that sometime in the 4th century, however, a copy was made to take to the new Roman capital, Constantinople. When the library at Alexandria was destroyed, this copy thus survived. Now, ironically, the very zealotry that had condemned so many of Alexandria's books would save it. When the Patriarch of Alexandria had the Patriarch of Constantinople declared a heretic, his followers had taken this copy of the Geographia with them into their desert exile. There it had been translated into Syriac, and then later into Arabic. The original copy had, of course, long since perished, but a few of those Arabic translations survived. The last of those had then, somehow, found its way into a bookseller's stock, and was now in Maximus Planudes' hands. The copy of the Geographia the monk now so fiercely bartered for was not complete, at least not in the way that he wished it to be, for there was a text, but no maps. We cannot be sure now that Ptolemy's original version even had maps, but that was what Maximus Planudes wanted, and having secured his prize, he returned to the monastery at Cora, where he began the painstaking task of noting all the details in the text and turning them back into the thing he craved, a series of maps. Soon a new rumour was flying around the Mediterranean. Planudes had a map of the world, Ptolemy's map of the world. The story came to the ears of the Byzantine emperor Andronicus II Palaeologus, who ordered a copy made for himself. Soon others were reconstructing, dividing, and improving the maps. By the 14th century, the 26 maps of the original version had been divided into 64, and one of these copies was obtained in 1400 by the Florentine patron Pallastrozzi, who persuaded a Byzantine scholar to translate the work from Planudes' Greek into Latin. Now the Geographia could at last be read by the academics of Europe, who, thanks to Christianity, retained their knowledge of Latin but had become largely ignorant of Greek. This version, finally finished around 1410, came into the royal courts of Europe at a time when interest in the exploration of the world, an interest that had slept for so long, was finally being rekindled. But none of the Renaissance princes who collected these wonders was more passionate than the Pope. If there were new lands to discover, then the papacy wanted to ensure that Catholicism travelled there with the explorers. So the little book that Planudes had discovered years before made its way to the Apostolic Library at the Vatican, along with many of its lavishly illustrated descendants. From the Vatican, copies would then be sent out across Europe. One of those would change the world. Introduction. For Alexandria lies, as it were, at the conjunction of the whole world. Dio Chrysostom, Orations. Most of us take it for granted that two cities, Athens and Rome, completely dominated the classical world. We are well aware that their achievements had a profound effect on Western civilization. Their legacy is still apparent, from the architecture of our public buildings to the phrasing of our laws. Even democracy itself was, we are told, their gift. But this is, in fact, a distorted view of history, fueled by generations awed by the might of Rome and the ingenuity of Athens, and perhaps a little too keen to take native historians of both cities at their word. In fact, there was a third city that, at its height, dwarfed both of these in wealth and population as well as in scientific and artistic achievement, largely overlooked by history. This city had a unique soul. While Greece and Rome spread their influence through trade and war, this city set out on another adventure, not at the point of a sword, but on the tip of a pen. Its triumph was to be a conquest of the mind, led not by legions of soldiers, but by dynasties of scholars navigating on a sea of books. This city was Alexandria. Within a few generations of its foundation, the city was the marvel of its age, not just for its size and beauty, its vast palaces, safe harbours and fabled lighthouse, or even for being the world's greatest emporium, its central market. Alexandria was built on knowledge, and at its heart was not a treasury, but the greatest library and museum of antiquity. Encouraged by the ruling Ptolemaic dynasty, this institution became the meeting place and crucible of all the great cultures and minds of the ancient world. It proved an intellectual magnet, attracting generation upon generation of the finest scholars, philosophers, poets, and inventors. Egyptians, Greeks, Jews, Babylonians, Persians, Gauls, Phoenicians, and Romans flocked here, stimulating huge advances in mathematics, astronomy and astrology, alchemy, optics, medicine and anatomy, grammar, geography, philosophy and theology. In short, the sum total of the wisdom of the ancient world. In these halls, the true foundations of the modern world were laid, not in stone, but in ideas. There was never anything like the great library and museum before, nor has there been since. The single place on earth where all the knowledge in the entire world was gathered together, every great play and poem, every book of physics and philosophy, the key to understanding, simply everything. That institution aimed to accumulate every book written, even from as far afield as India, and at its zenith it was said to contain 750,000 scrolls. Here were not only the works of the brilliant scholars of their own time, but also those of their illustrious predecessors, of Homer, Pythagoras, and Herodotus, of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, names that might otherwise be unknown to us. Other libraries since have held more books. Indeed, today the Library of Congress in Washington and the British Library in London hold between them nearly every book printed in the last 200 years, and many more besides. But they are not complete, not least because most of the knowledge of the first 1,000 years of Western civilization is missing. These were the books that formed the Library of Alexandria, and only a handful have been seen since that library's tragic destruction. All that remains is perhaps 1% of the works that were once lodged there, the chance survivors of that shipwreck of human achievement. The romance of Athens and the might of Rome have overshadowed the Hellenistic civilization spawned by the vast conquests of Alexander. Somehow the people of this place and their extraordinarily modern ideas have fallen down the gap between where classical Greece ended and imperial Rome began. So our first aim in this book is to look again at Alexandria, to reconstruct the life of the institutions that made it unique, the library and the museum, and to breathe life back into a city that was once the center of the world. Physically, there is almost nothing left of ancient Alexandria, but among the drowned ruins in her harbor, in the fragments of the books that survive from her great library, and hidden among the works of later authors, lie the keys to this city of wonders. It was a city of mechanical marvels, of an anatomy school where the circulation of the blood was understood 2,000 years before it was previously thought possible, of geographers who knew the earth was spherical and travelled around the sun, of philosophers who even conjectured that everything was made of microscopically small particles called atoms, from the Greek atomos, indivisible. This was the home of Euclid, the father of geometry, whose books are still in print 2,000 years after his death, and of Archimedes, of Eureka fame. Here, too, was the young Galen, the greatest doctor and physiologist of the age, and Claudius Ptolemy, the father of both astronomy and geography, and Apollonius, the author of Jason and the Argonauts. Stranger names, but no less influential, include Eratosthenes, the first man to measure the circumference of the earth, Aristarchus, the first to envisage a heliocentric solar system, Plotinus, a founder of Neoplatonism, Clement of Alexandria, a father of Christian theology, Arius, perhaps the first great Christian heretic, and Philo, the radical Jewish theologian. These are just a few of the host of geniuses who walked and talked, debated and denounced, read copiously, and finally set pen to paper in the great library and museum attached to the royal palaces of Alexandria. And while some of these legions of scholars are still household names, remembered for their mastery of one or two fields of study, it was the declared aim of all to achieve mastery in all fields of study, all branches of knowledge. And some actually achieved this, turning themselves truly into philosophers, lovers of wisdom, and reaching intellectual heights never achieved before or since. The story of each of these characters tells a part of the history of Alexandria, a history peopled by the political giants of the ancient world, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, and Cleopatra. Our aim in this book is to explore, within the framework of this turbulent political history, the ways in which human knowledge and understanding developed and evolved in this extraordinary city, to trace the evolution of the Alexandrian way, which stimulated a dramatic acceleration in our appreciation not just of science and the material world, but also of literature, metaphysics, philosophy, and religion. To do this, we have had to follow the Alexandrian way ourselves, to some extent, by first reading everything we could find on all the people, subjects, and events in Alexandria's long history, the flotsam and jetsam from the shipwreck of time. We have then laid out those pieces and tried to discover the patterns lying behind them, to fill in the lacunae, the gaps, so that we might explore both the physical and mental worlds of the city and its people. Wherever possible, we have returned to first-hand testimonies, and let the people of Alexandria speak for themselves, not merely to restore voices so often drowned out by Rome and Athens, but to try to convey a sense of what it must have been like to actually be there, and experience the journey of discovery that was life at the conjunction of the whole world. In their words, we can walk again in the corridors of the world's first and only true university, and reach out for the long-lost scrolls of the library itself. We can gaze upon the golden mausoleum of Alexander, and discover the cold body of Cleopatra in her quayside palace. We can see the world they knew around them and explore the yet stranger worlds of their minds in a story that begins with the rise of the Ptolemies, the heirs of Alexander, and the last tragic dynasty in 3 millennia of pharaohs. We will then pass through the conquest by Octavian into the shadow of the Roman Empire, and end with the triumph of Christianity, the death of the last librarian, and the destruction of the library and the city itself. In this book, we will not only return to the lost wonders of Alexandria, we will also try to enter the mind of the city, to discover why it produced such an extraordinary flowering of creativity, knowledge, and understanding. And we will discover that at the core of this dazzling whirlpool of ideas lies the thing you are reading now, the written word. Words encoded in grammars, bound as books, and held in libraries, allow the transmission of ideas from one mind to the next over the generations, and the transformation of those ideas into new, fresh thoughts as they travel. While the early Greek scholars and philosophers mostly preferred to establish private schools where their thoughts would be transmitted face to face, master to pupil, it was in the great libraries of Alexandria that the real power of the written word burst forth upon generation after generation of scholars who could read, and so hold in their minds the voices of the world's great thinkers, speaking to them across the distant expanses of space and time. Alexandria was the greatest mental crucible the world has ever known, the place where ideas originating in obscure antiquity were forged into intellectual constructs that far outlasted the city itself. If the Renaissance was the rebirth of learning that led to our modern world, then Alexandria was its original birthplace. Our politics may be modelled on Greek prototypes, our public architecture on Roman antecedents. But in our minds, we are all the children of Alexandria. Chapter 1. Flower and Sand. History is a child building a sandcastle by the sea, and that child is the whole majesty of man's power in the world. Heraclitus, Heraclitus and Diogenes. From atop the walls of the castle of Kite Bay in Egypt, you can look across the rocky coast on which the castle stands, to where fishing boats still ride at anchor in the bay, and local children fling themselves from the rocks into the warm, clear sea that laps the shore. It is a sight familiar to perhaps thousands of shorelines around the Mediterranean, a timeless scene that, with only a few modifications, could come from just about any century. But few shores have seen as much history wash across them as this one has. The very stones of the castle you look out from once belonged to one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, and the shoreline beyond, boats, children, and all, was a scene that once reached the ears of the Greek poet Homer. According to Plutarch of Chaeronea, it was through Homer that this place came to the attention of perhaps the greatest general in all history, who, over 2,300 years before you, stood on this same shore, his precious copy of Homer locked in a golden casket in his hands. But when he turned from the sea and looked south, he saw only a narrow strip of water separating this island from the mainland, and beyond that, an empty coast to which only the smallest of villages clung. When you turn, you will no longer find that scene, for in its place has risen the city founded there by that man, that dreamer, the huge, heaving metropolis of Alexandria. At the time Homer wrote, there had been some sort of Bronze Age trading post here, almost certainly more impressive than the settlement Alexander found. But Homer's words echoed through the centuries to Alexander, and the mention of this place changed his mind about a great project he was planning. Plutarch tells us that he had it in mind to build a great Greek city on this Egyptian coast, one which would receive the ultimate honour of bearing his name. His architects and surveyors had thus been dispatched, and had selected a suitable site where work was just about to begin. Then he had a dream. As he was sleeping, he saw a remarkable vision. He thought he could see a man with very white hair and a venerable appearance standing beside him and speaking these lines. Then there is an island in the stormy sea in front of Egypt. They call it Pharos. He rose at once and went to Pharos. Plutarch, Life of Alexander, In Parallel Lives. What he found here was a strip of land running east-west, with a large lake to the south and the Mediterranean Sea to the north. Just off that coast stood the island Homer had mentioned, Pharos, and it soon became clear to Alexander, or his architects at least, that by joining this island to the mainland with a causeway, two great harbours would be created, making the safest and largest anchorage on the whole of the north coast of Egypt. Alexander was delighted, and exclaimed that Homer was admirable in other respects, and was also an excellent architect, and ordered the plan of the city to be drawn in conformity with the terrain. And so, on this coast in early 331 BC, a strange sight could be seen. On what had once been the quietest of shores, the cries of thousands of birds could now be heard. Anyone sailing down this coast might have seen the great flock wheeling in the blinding Egyptian sun, and beneath them on the beach a small encampment. But these were not desperate, lost desert travellers, patiently circled by the ever-watchful vultures. They were Alexander's men, and the birds that dived again and again on them were not harbingers of a death, but of a birth. Closer inspection might have shown the reason for the birds' interest. Crisscrossing the sandy shore were lines of barley flour, carefully poured out by workmen walking behind teams of surveyors, who calculated angles and distances using tools unchanged since the days of the pyramid builders. The entire area now lay under a net of these white lines, attended to by countless small birds that did their best to eat them as fast as they were laid. Had we been able to see this work from on high, as the birds did when they flew up, we might have seen their purpose, to lay out a new harbour. And around this harbour they were to describe an entire city. It seemed like madness, but an inspired, perhaps even divine, lunacy. The idea to use flour had come from one who now stood among them. It was a practical solution to the lack of chalk in Egypt, but typically an impulsive and perhaps not wholly thought-out one. As fast as the lines were laid, the birds descended and ate them. Some of the workmen muttered that it was an omen, and a bad one at that. What good could come from a city that the gods tried to eradicate the very moment it was first laid out? However, Alexander's personal soothsayer, Aristander, countered that it simply showed that Alexandria would one day feed the whole world. And according to an ancient source known today as the Pseudo-Callisthenes, in the Alexander Romance, when the great man consulted the Egyptian gods himself on the matter, he was told, "The city you are building will be the food-giver and nurse of the whole world." So the work on the shore, opposite the little island of Pharos, progressed painfully slowly. Alexander, however, could not wait. Within a few days he had gone, perhaps a little bored by the daily drudgery of deciding where palaces and temples should go, but also tempted away by a new idea that had seized him while designing his city. It had been suggested to him by some Egyptians that he might not be a man at all, but a god, for surely only a god could achieve what he had done. It was flattery, of course, but in a heroic age and on the lips of an ancient people, perhaps it was more. Either way, he set off with all speed to the desert shrine of Amon to discover if it was indeed true. Thus Plutarch describes the foundation of the city of Alexandria by its first and greatest son, Alexander the Great. As with so much about Alexander's life, it can be difficult to separate fact from myth in a story filled with omens and peopled by gods. The ancient sources do not even agree on whether Alexander founded his city before or after he spoke to the oracle at the shrine of Amon in Siwa. But what all do agree on is that he alone chose the place, and the choice was a spectacularly good one. Lying on the Mediterranean coast, west of the Nile, this was an area that had not been well integrated into the ancient Egyptian states of the Old, Middle, and New Kingdoms. This is not to suggest that the area was completely empty, however. Excavations have shown that a small fishing village called Rakotis had existed here since the 13th century BC, and the value of the anchorage was indeed known to Homer, whether or not he appeared to Alexander in a dream to remind him, as he wrote in the Odyssey, "Now off Egypt, about as far as a ship can sail in a day with a good stiff breeze behind her, there is an island called Pharos. It has a good harbour, from which vessels can get out into open sea when they have taken in water." Homer, Odyssey. Some evidence of the prehistoric harbour that Homer knew of has even been found off the shores of the island of Pharos. In the early years of the 20th century, Gaston Jondé, the chief engineer of ports and lights in Egypt, noted an extensive series of breakwaters beneath the present sea level which were unmentioned in classical texts. These had formed a Bronze Age harbour at a time when the Egypt of Ramesses the Great and Tutankhamun traded extensively with the Minoan world, providing a port free from the choking silt of the delta. But they had already fallen into disuse and disappeared beneath the waves by the time Alexander arrived here. It is apposite, perhaps, that it should be Homer, a Greek source, who first makes mention of this place, for it was a Greek who was about to transform it. Alexander was born in late July of 356 BC into the royal family of an ascendant Macedonian state. Under his father, King Philip II, the nation of Macedon, to the north of classical Greece, had extended its influence south and east across the Mediterranean, becoming a key player in Greek international politics. Greek culture mattered to Philip, and he ensured that his son received the very best Greek education available. Indeed, Alexander's personal tutor was Aristotle, one of the most influential philosophers in all of Western thought. The tales of Alexander's promising childhood are legion, from his taming of the supposedly uncontrollable horse Bucephalus to his father's exhortation that he should conquer a land suitable for his ambition, as Macedon was too small for him. Most of these legends grew up after the events, of course, to help explain the extraordinary rise of the young Macedonian. After the assassination of Philip by his bodyguard, Pausanias, at a wedding banquet, possibly at the instigation of the new king of Persia, Darius III, Alexander was quickly proclaimed king by the Macedonian army. He was clearly already held in high regard, and so at just 20 years of age began the most remarkable military career in history. If Alexander's father had been assassinated on Persian orders, Darius III would come to regret the decision. With an army of over 40,000 men, Alexander first marched south to consolidate his hold over the city-states of mainland Greece, and then crossed over the Hellespont into Asia to confront Darius in person. After defeating a Persian force at the Battle of Granicus, he stormed down the Ionian seaboard like an avenging angel, liberating the wealthy Greek trading ports that lined the coast on the way. He besieged Halicarnassus, then turned inland to the ancient Phrygian capital of Gordium, where, so legend has it, he chose to tackle the problem of the Gordian Knot. The legend goes that at a time when Phrygia found itself without a king, an ancient oracle prophesied that the first man to enter the capital in an ox cart should be their next king. That man was the peasant Gordius, who, in return for his sudden change in fortune, dedicated his cart to the gods, tying its shafts to a post in an elaborate knot. The oracle then further prophesied that whoever could undo the knot would be king of all Asia. It had been a problem that had bothered would-be rulers of the world from that moment on. The knot was allegedly fiendishly complicated, without protruding ends, and hence impossible to unpick. But Alexander found a simple solution. He drew his sword and sliced the knot in half. And as the oracle predicted, he did indeed go on to become master of all Asia. That at least is how Alexander's friends and propagandists told it. From Gordium he then passed through the Cilician Gates, the high pass into the Tarsus Mountains of modern-day Turkey, and into central Anatolia to face the Persian Empire head-on. At the Battle of Issus in 333 BC, Darius III was defeated and fled the field, leaving his mother, wife, and children to be captured by Alexander. Also among the spoils was the golden casket belonging to the Persian king, in which he placed his beloved copy of Homer. Alexander chose not to pursue the fleeing Persian across the Euphrates, but instead continued south, besieging coastal cities as he went. Where he was heading became clear in 332 BC, when he was welcomed into Egypt as the nation's liberator. possibly with the connivance of the Persian governor of Egypt, and certainly with the active support of the native Egyptian bureaucracy, the country was ceded to him without so much as a skirmish, and Alexander was king of Egypt at the age of 23. By the time Alexander first set foot on Egyptian soil, that civilization was already some 3,000 years old. But this was not the Egypt of Khufu and Ramses. The pyramids of the Old Kingdom were already over 2,000 years old, while the magnificence of the New Kingdom courts of Amenhotep III and Tutankhamun had faded and passed a millennium before. Egypt's recent history had been crueler. Since 525 BC, it had been a subject nation of the Persian Empire, and its nominal pharaoh, the 27th dynasty, was in fact the Achaemenid Shah, currently Darius III. The proud and ancient nation of Egypt had not taken kindly to Persian rule, and throughout the period links between native Egyptians and Greek merchants had been growing, fostered by their mutual antipathy toward the occupying superpower. Some Egyptian cults had even taken root back in Greece. In 333 BC, the Athenians had allowed Egyptian merchants to buy land for a temple to their goddess Isis, wife of the god of the underworld Osiris. There were also Greek merchants living in Egypt and adopting elements of its religion, particularly the worship of Isis, which in the following centuries would spread across the Mediterranean and, under Roman rule, reach as far as Britain. There were even Greeks in the civil administration, and so, though Alexander was a foreigner, the Egyptians welcomed him with open arms as a Greek and their nation's liberator. That Alexander wanted Egypt as part of his expanding empire was obvious. Despite the fact that so many of her glories were centuries, if not millennia, in the past, Egypt still retained a highly complex, literate culture with a wealth of esoteric knowledge, especially in astronomy, mathematics, and alchemy, knowledge which Greeks such as Pythagoras and Herodotus had sought out in the recent past. But more important for Alexander, Egypt was still a very wealthy nation with access to gold, slaves, and exotic African imports from the south, and rich in grain. The irrigated fields around the Nile were a huge source of food that not only kept Egypt itself fed, but also provided a surplus that could be exported for profit or used in military adventures. Then there was Egypt's position, directly across the Mediterranean from Greece, with a major river navigable far into the south. A pharaonic canal cut between that river and the Red Sea would provide access to the Indian Ocean for a ruler with the ambition to attempt a conquest of India, a ruler with the ambition of an Alexander. And so it was with these thoughts in mind that Alexander first came to the tiny village of Rakotis. In the heyday of the Egyptian pharaohs, life had been concentrated on the Nile Valley, and while some New Kingdom rulers had ventured beyond her borders to carve out empires, Egypt was traditionally insular and inward-looking. It focused on the Nile Valley, not the Mediterranean, and thus little effort had been spent on developing the northern coast outside the delta. But for Alexander, things were different. The Mediterranean, not the Nile, bound his world together, and a port on this coast would provide the quickest way of supplying his army and controlling his empire. Here, then, he found a unique location on a dangerous coast. To the south of the site lay Mariotis, a 100-square-mile lake. To the east was the mouth of the Canopic branch of the Nile and the rest of the delta, offering access to Egypt's wealth and connections on to the Red Sea. To the north, just offshore, stood the island known as Pharos. Aside from the two harbours created by a causeway from Pharos to the mainland, canals could connect the Canopic Nile to the lake, and the lake to the sea. In terms of trade, it was simply a perfect location. The geographer Strabo, who visited the city some 300 years after its foundation, also noted another great benefit. And in addition to the great value of the things brought down from both directions, both into the harbour on the sea and into that on the lake, the salubrity of the air is also worthy of remark. And this likewise results from the fact that the land is washed by water on both sides, and because of the timeliness of the Nile's risings. For the other cities that are situated on lakes have heavy and stifling air in the heats of summer, because the lakes then become marshy along their edges because of the evaporation caused by the sun's rays, and accordingly, when so much filth-laden moisture rises, The air inhaled is noisome and starts pestilential diseases. Whereas at Alexandria, at the beginning of summer, the Nile, being full, fills the lake also, and leaves no marshy matter to corrupt the rising vapours. At that time, also, the Etesian winds blow from the north and from a vast sea. Alexandrians pass their time most pleasantly in summer. Strabo, Geography. This might seem like little more than a pleasant conceit, but finding a healthy location away from the slow-moving and polluted waters of the Delta, where disease was rife in the summer, was a masterstroke. The site was cool, clean, and accessible from abroad, and that in Egypt was rare. It must have seemed to be the perfect location for a provincial capital. And so, with the decision made, Alexander moved off again. There was one further place the Macedonian king had to visit while in Egypt, and this visit would have profound implications both for Alexander and for the dynasty of Greek pharaohs that would soon be established in his city of Alexandria. As he rode through the western desert toward the shrine of Ammon at Siwa, he could hardly have imagined that he would never return alive to the city he had just founded. He had left behind a capital of sand and flour, just a preliminary sketch, before dashing off once more in his endless, restless pursuit of yet greater achievements. But what he did next would help secure the future of that sketch, and ensure that this city would be his home in death, if not in life. Even today, the oasis of Siwa is an extraordinary sight. Standing lost between the Katara Depression and the Great Sand Sea, it lies in one of the most remote and inhospitable parts of the country. Legend has it that when King Cambyses II of Persia first conquered Egypt, his entire army of 50,000 men vanished somewhere in the emptiness of the surrounding desert as they marched in search of the oasis. Under Roman rule, its very remoteness made it famous as a place of banishment. It is only after mile upon mile of dunes and dry rock that the oasis suddenly appears, a great swath of green, filled with a forest of palm trees over which towers the old fortress of Shali. Here also, in the now nearly abandoned village of Agurmi, stand the remains of what brought Alexander and perhaps Cambyses to this place, the Temple of Ammon. In the temple was an oracle popular among the Egyptians, although no pharaoh had ever visited the site, and widely respected in the Greek world. The deity worshipped here was clearly Egyptian, as Diodorus Siculus's description makes clear. The image of the god is encrusted with emeralds and other precious stones, and answers those who consult the oracle in a quite peculiar fashion. It is carried about upon a golden boat by 80 priests, and these, with the god on their shoulders, go without their own volition wherever the god directs their path. A multitude of girls and women follows them, singing paeans as they go, and praising the god in a traditional hymn. Diodorus Siculus, Library of History. But if the god was worshipped here in a particularly Egyptian form, the spread of the cult across the Mediterranean to Greece, where it was known as the cult of the Libyan Ammon, made this a perfect bridge between Alexander's Greek roots and an Egypt he needed to rule in a manner Egyptians would accept. The oracle, we are told, had news for Alexander about his lineage, news that not only would cause ructions in the Greek world, but would begin the process of turning Greek conquerors into Egyptian pharaohs. We are told that as Alexander approached the temple, the priest welcomed him, calling him Child of the God. He then invited him into the adytum, the interior of the temple usually reserved exclusively for the priests. The rest of the king's entourage had to wait in the courtyard. Just what Alexander asked the oracle in the darkened silence of the Temple of Ammon is disputed. According to Plutarch, citing an anonymous source, the king asked two questions. He inquired whether any one of his father's murderers had escaped, to which the priest answered that he must not ask such questions, for his father was more than man. Alexander now altered the form of his inquiry and asked whether he had punished all the murderers of Philip, and then he asked another question about his empire, whether he was fated to conquer all mankind. On receiving as an answer that this would be granted to him, and that Philip had been amply avenged, he made splendid presents to the god and amply rewarded the priests. Plutarch, Life of Alexander. But even Plutarch is suspicious of this story, though he is happy to repeat it. He and many other ancient authors felt that what passed between Alexander and the oracle was almost certainly kept secret. But what mattered to the Greeks in the king's party, and what would matter to later generations of Egyptians, is that from this meeting grew the idea that Alexander was not the son of Philip of Macedon, but the son of the god Ammon himself. The idea that Alexander was a living god was treated with great scepticism by the ancient Greeks, who generally thought only the dead were worthy of deification. Indeed, by the time of Plutarch, there was even a story current that the whole idea of Alexander's immortal ancestry came about through a misunderstanding at Siwa. Plutarch tells us that some believed that the priest who emerged from the temple to greet Alexander mispronounced the Greek, "O Paideon, O my child," and instead called out, "O Paideos," which could, to a Greek ear, sound like, "O Paideos, O child of the god." By the 2nd century AD, the author Lucian found the idea of the divine Alexander humorous enough to make fun of him in one of his Dialogues of the Dead, in which Alexander discovers in the underworld, somewhat to his surprise, that he is not a god. Diogenes: "Dear me, Alexander, you dead like the rest of us?" Alexander: "As you see, sir. Is there anything extraordinary in a mortal's dying?" Diogenes: "So Ammon lied when he said you were his son. You were Philip's, after all." Alexander: "Apparently. If I had been Ammon's, I should not have died." Diogenes: "Strange. There were tales of the same order about Olympias, too. A serpent visited her and was seen in her bed. We were given to understand that that was how you came into the world, and Philip made a mistake when he took you for his." Alexander: "Yes, I was told all that myself. However, I know now that my mother's and the Ammon stories were all moonshine." Diogenes: "Their lies were of some practical value to you, though. Your divinity brought a good many people to their knees." Lucian, Dialogues of the Dead. And in that last line from Diogenes lay Alexander's genius. While the Greeks could not easily accept that they were ruled by a living god, the Egyptians had kept this central to their beliefs for 3,000 years. Herodotus said that the Egyptians were the most religious of all peoples, and their beliefs imbued every element of their society. Egypt was a theocracy, where the majority of the large agricultural estates were owned by temples and managed by an elite caste of priests whose positions were often hereditary. The power built up by these institutions had grown century by century as the god-kings of the three ancient Egyptian kingdoms had granted them more and more land and rights. Between the pharaoh and the temples, not only was the economy organized, but in Egyptian eyes, the relationship between humans and gods was also managed. The ruler of Egypt was seen as Horus, the son of the god Osiris, and the mediator between the worlds of the everyday and the divine. Through his interaction with the temples and his performance of the kingly rites in those temples, a state of harmony, Maat, was maintained in the world. The stars would continue to circle in the heavens, the Nile would flood once a year, and so life in Egypt would go on as it had for thousands of years. While the Greeks sneered at men who called themselves gods, the Egyptians actively required it of their rulers. So it served Alexander well to be considered divine in their eyes. Whether he believed it to be true himself is another and perhaps unknowable matter. God or not, the Oracle of Ammon inspired Alexander to keep up his relentless pace of conquest. Leaving Egypt, he finally and comprehensively defeated the Persians at the Battle of Gaugamela, before striking out east through Medea, Parthia, and Scythia, on through Afghanistan and into India. His fleet crossed the Indian Ocean from west to east and then back again, restless, relentless, and as unstoppable as the ever-shifting mind that drove it forward. But he was chasing a desert mirage. By the time he was 32 years old, his vast empire was already tottering, weighed down by self-interest and riven with factional infighting. As he returned to Babylon, omens of his impending death began to appear. Just outside the city, a Chaldean astronomer appeared before him and warned him that entering the city, or in some versions of the story, entering the city from the east, would bring about his death. Alexander lived in a world of omens and oracles, and the prophecies of the celestial seers of Babylon, the writers of the Book of Heaven, were not lightly cast aside. Their astronomical diaries had proved so accurate that Alexander had ordered them translated into Greek and sent to his old tutor Aristotle for inspection. This led within a year to the complete reform of the Greek calendar. So powerful, so widely believed were the prophecies of these men that they could easily become self-fulfilling. Their predictions of Darius's doom may have helped to unsettle his army, and hence put Alexander on the Persian throne in the first place. Now those prophecies were aimed against Alexander himself. Alexander did, however, finally enter the city, and in doing so embarked on the last days of his life, just as the astronomers had predicted. In these final moments, legends begin to crowd in even more thickly around the man. The ancient sources now tell a strange tale. According to Arrian, Alexander went to inspect his soldiers, and while he was away from the throne room, an escaped convict broke in, put on the insignia of the king, and sat on his throne. When discovered and asked why he was doing this, he made no reply, or, according to Plutarch, he claimed he had been released by the supreme god. Alexander was troubled and consulted the wise men in Babylon, who advised that the man should be put to death, so that the bad luck this foretold might fall on his shoulders and not the king's. Recent research suggests, however, that this peculiar legend may be the surviving echo of an eyewitness account of an ancient Babylonian ritual which neither Alexander nor later classical writers understood. When Babylonian astronomers predicted inauspicious times, it was the custom for the priests to release a convict and place him on the throne as a substitute king in place of the real ruler. Then any bad luck that befell the kingdom during this ominous time would fall on the shoulders of the criminal, not the king, and hence the state. When the danger passed, the criminal would be executed, taking his ill fortune to the grave with him. This was then perhaps the scene that Alexander stumbled upon, but its resolution did not ease his foreboding. He now fell into a dark mood, mistrustful of his friends and fearful for his future. Plutarch says that the Babylonian palace soon filled with soothsayers and sacrifices, and that the slightest strange thing would be taken by Alexander as an omen, and a bad omen at that. And he had every right to worry. Alexander's final illness came on during a drinking party, and his decline was then rapid. Diodorus Siculus takes up the story. There he drank much unmixed wine in commemoration of the death of Heracles, and finally, filling a huge beaker, downed it at a gulp. Instantly he shrieked aloud as if smitten by a violent blow, and was conducted by his friends, who led him by the hand back to his apartments. His chamberlains put him to bed and attended him closely, but the pain increased, and the physicians were summoned. No one was able to do anything helpful, and Alexander continued in great discomfort and acute suffering. Diodorus Siculus, Library of History. He died in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar II on the afternoon of June the 10th, 323 BC. He was 32 years old. The cause of Alexander's death has been disputed since the moment he breathed his last, and a full investigation is outside the scope of this book. Some ancient authors maintain he died of an illness, perhaps malaria or typhoid. Others report that he was poisoned, perhaps with belladonna, since Plutarch states that he was unable to speak shortly before the end, and paralysis of the vocal cords is a symptom of poisoning with deadly nightshade. He further suggests, as does Arrian, that some thought the poisoning to have been carried out at the instigation of Aristotle, who feared that the king's imprisonment of the chronicler Callisthenes for complaining about the king's growing arrogance signalled that Alexander's success had made him uncontrollable. In this version of events, Aristotle procured a poison which was conveyed to Alexander's court in the hoof of a mule. These possibilities have since been elaborately embroidered by centuries of storytellers, until the astonishing tale of Alexander's death has become filled with weeping horses, total eclipses, and speaking birds. What did matter, regardless of the cause of his death, was that the largest empire on earth was now effectively leaderless, and there was a limited amount of time in which the king's surviving family and generals could make their pitch for part or all of his inheritance. Exactly who should now rule in his place was not clear. Alexander had a half-brother, Philip III, Arrhidaeus, who was the son of Philip II and Philinna of Larissa, but he seems to have been simple-minded and incapable of taking on sole rule of so great an empire in anything more than name. Despite this, he was the choice of the army in Babylon, and hence nominally became Alexander's heir. A few months after Alexander's death, his Bactrian wife, Roxana, gave birth to his son, who was immediately declared king and joined his uncle on the throne as Alexander IV of Macedon. So it came to pass that the heirs of the greatest ruler of the ancient world were a fool and a baby. The vast empire he had held together with little more than the power of his own will almost immediately began to disintegrate. Infighting erupted among Alexander's once loyal generals, as each grasped feverishly for a piece of his crumbling inheritance. But there was little concrete to grab. For all his military brilliance, Alexander's attempts at governing his empire had bred hostility and dissent. In Persia, his willingness to take on Persian customs, both in government and in dress, might have helped him to hold on to those lands, as his adoption of a pharaonic style of government in Egypt ensured his popularity there. But both practices were highly distasteful to other Macedonians. They were the conquerors, and few saw why they shouldn't rule the empire they had won in a Macedonian way. Their arrogance would ensure the fragmentation of Alexander's world. Only one man had realized the true nature of Alexander's legacy, his childhood friend, confidant, and senior general, Ptolemy. He had been with Alexander from the start, and even accompanied him to the Oracle of Ammon at Siwa. He was also present in Babylon when Alexander died, and a few days after the death called together the two other generals closest to Alexander. His view was that there was little hope in trying to maintain a leaderless single empire spanning Asia, North Africa, the Middle East, and the Eastern Mediterranean. Better to divide it up into its three principal constituent parts, which each one of them could rule. He suggested they form a ruling council which would meet regularly to keep affairs on an even keel. This extraordinarily far-sighted proposal anticipated the inevitable frictions between what were at that moment the three most powerful people in the world, and offered a solution to the problem. But both the other generals dreamed of succeeding Alexander as sole supreme emperor. They rejected Ptolemy's proposal outright, thereby setting the stage for the centuries of interfactional warfare which would follow. Ptolemy, realizing full well that it was now each man for himself, left immediately for Egypt, the richest and most self-contained part of Alexander's empire. Meanwhile, Alexander's body, already taking on the attributes of divinity, was prepared for travel, as Curtius Rufus recounts, although he claims that he for one does not believe the story. Although the king's body had lain in the coffin for 6 days in scorching heat, there was no sign of decay when the Egyptians and Chaldeans came to embalm it. A golden sarcophagus was filled with perfumes, and on Alexander's head was placed the insignia of his rank, Quintus Curtius Rufus, Alexander the Great. Diodorus adds that after the embalmers had made the body sweet-smelling and incorruptible with the embalming materials of the region, frankincense, myrrh, beeswax, and honey, the whole body was wrapped in linen and sealed in exquisitely beaten gold sheets, so finely figured to his form that his features were still recognizable through them. It was widely assumed that his corpse would be returned home to his birthplace, Macedon, in northern Greece, but Ptolemy realized that this was no ordinary body. Alexander, if not a god himself, had certainly seemed to have been touched by the gods, and the magical aura that surrounded him in life might also remain in death, in much the way that the bones of saints held a remarkable power over living minds in the Middle Ages. Other than an empire which was already tottering on the brink of civil war, the most valuable thing of Alexander's for any successor was not his lands, or money, or fame, but his body, the ultimate icon of the ultimate ruler. Here was an object whose value would only grow as the years passed and the myths evolved. This realization had not been lost on Alexander's friends, even during his lifetime, when, according to a legend retold by Aelian, Alexander's favorite soothsayer Aristander had predicted that the country in which his body was buried would be the most prosperous in the world. Ptolemy knew what he had to do. He had to take for himself a part of Alexander's empire he could rule and defend alone, and the jewel he would set in that new nation's crown was the gold-clad body of Alexander himself. Chapter 2. Stealing a God. Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter's rages. Thou thy worldly task hast done. Home art gone, and ten thy wages. Golden lads and girls all must, as chimney-sweepers, come to dust. William Shakespeare, Cymbeline. While the fighting between the heirs of Alexander intensified, Ptolemy quietly secured his position as ruler of Egypt, as he was uniquely well-equipped to do so, having been with Alexander from childhood. He had watched the man at work, learned from his successes, and learned still more from his failures. Ptolemy was the son of a nobleman called Lagus, a member of a relatively obscure Macedonian family. Indeed, so obscure was it that when Ptolemy eventually achieved greatness himself, wild stories quickly became embroidered around the prosaic facts of his ancestry. The pro-Ptolemaic faction even claimed that he was the illegitimate son of Philip II. For their part, those ranged against Ptolemy told the story of how he had once asked a grammarian the famously difficult question, "Who was the father of Pelops?" only to receive the reply, "I will tell you as soon as you tell me who was the father of Lagus." But for all the obscurity of his ancestry, Lagus did ensure that his son received an education at Philip II's court. Here he was appointed a page, during which time he became a close friend of the young Alexander, and one of the group of five youths charged with mentoring the king's son. In this situation, he was able to watch the impressive Philip at work, carving out a Macedonian empire and building the army that his son would one day unleash on the world. He must also have enjoyed the culture of the court, and perhaps shared the privilege of being taught by the tutor Philip had appointed for his son Alexander, the great Aristotle. But he had shared in Alexander's tribulations as well as in his good fortunes. In the Pixodorus affair, Alexander had nearly been gulled into marrying the daughter of one of the heirs of King Mausolus, whose capital at Halicarnassus Alexander would later besiege. It was a match Philip knew to be inappropriate, and he managed to forbid it, despite Alexander's having apparently already agreed. For this, the prince and his mentors, including Ptolemy, were exiled, only to return upon the old king's death. This turbulent childhood and youth moulded Ptolemy into an extraordinarily shrewd young man and his prince's ablest companion, as they set out to conquer the world together. He had been appointed one of Alexander's seven personal bodyguards, and had played key roles in the campaigns in Afghanistan and India, although Arrian's descriptions of his heroics, drawn from Ptolemy's own account of Alexander's life, betray a tendency to exaggerate his importance. But most important of all, Ptolemy had learned to watch and wait, to see but remain silent. That was the great advantage he had over his old friend Alexander. Ptolemy was not in a hurry. After Alexander's death, the situation became delicate, and having been with Alexander at Siwa and in Memphis, Ptolemy knew the Egyptian people had to be treated carefully if he was to retain their loyalty in the dangerous years ahead. As such, he made no pretense of kingship, made no bid for the pharaonic throne so recently vacated by his friend and master. Instead, he contented himself with the old Persian title satrap, effectively making himself governor of Egypt. Even this careful move did not leave him without enemies. Alexander had appointed a man called Cleomenes to administer the Delta area and raise the funds for the building of Alexandria. Cleomenes was a businessman, an extortionist, and a crook. Of those who wrote about him, none had a good word to say for him. Demosthenes called him a dishonest manipulator, while Arrian pulled even fewer punches and just branded him an evil man. The cause of such hatred was, at least in part, his sheer success. He had been so successful, indeed, and felt so confident, that he had declared himself satrap while Alexander was still in India. On returning, the king had admonished him for his presumption, but, extraordinarily, hadn't dismissed him for it. He'd generated far too much money for that. As part of the initial settlement among Alexander's generals upon his death, Ptolemy had now taken the title of satrap of Egypt for himself, but in doing so he was taking a risk. Alexander's empire was crumbling, and Cleomenes had already shown that he had the nerve to take on the Macedonian state. How long would this hugely wealthy individual put up with Ptolemy as his master? For now this powerful but increasingly unpopular man could not be unseated, so in taking the title satrap for himself, Ptolemy appointed Cleomenes as his assistant, Hipparchos. Most likely neither felt content with this, but the final resolution would have to wait. And waiting is what Ptolemy was becoming good at. The end of Alexander's reign had been marked by confusion, and time seems to have done little to clarify the situation. As such, the preparations for Alexander's body's final journey home were anything but quick. Indeed, it was 2 years before news came from Babylon that the sarcophagus of Alexander was finally on the move. The procession must have made quite an impression. The king's body had been placed inside 2 golden caskets, the outer one draped with a purple robe on which lay Alexander's armour. This coffin was then mounted on a specially constructed golden carriage with a vaulted roof supported by slender Ionic columns. Diodorus describes the scene. At the top of the carriage was built a vault of gold, 8 cubits wide and 12 long, covered with overlapping scales set with precious stones. Beneath the roof, all along the work, was a rectangular cornice of gold from which projected heads of goat stags in high relief. Gold rings, 2 palms broad, were suspended from these, and through the rings there ran a festive garland beautifully decorated in bright colours of all kinds. At the ends, there were tassels of network suspending large bells, so that any who were approaching heard the sound from a great distance. On each corner of the vault, on each side, was a golden figure of victory, holding a trophy. Diodorus Siculus, Library of History. But that was only the beginning. Diodorus goes on to explain how the carriage lavishly advertised the already partly mythical achievements of Alexander. On the vault over Alexander's body was strung a golden net, on which were suspended long painted tablets, one on each side. On the first of these was a chariot carved in relief, on which sat Alexander, sceptre in hand, surrounded by Macedonian and Persian attendants. On the second tablet were carved war elephants, complete with mahouts and regular Macedonian troops. The third tablet portrayed Alexander's impressive cavalry in battle formation, while the fourth showed his navy ready for combat. At the entrance to the chamber itself, there were golden lions whose eyes, so Diodorus tells us, turned to watch those who would enter this holy of holies. Above the chamber, he adds, there was a purple banner blazoned with a golden olive wreath of great size, and when the sun cast upon it its rays, it sent forth such a bright and vibrant gleam that from a great distance it appeared like a flash of lightning. Diodorus Siculus, Library of History. Here, then, condensed into one fabulous vehicle, was the achievement of Alexander. A glittering advertisement for all that he had been and all that he could have been. Its single remaining task was to bear away the body of the man whose life it portrayed. Finally, in 321 BC, the carriage, drawn by 64 mules and accompanied by a great procession, wound its way through the streets of Babylon and out into the countryside beyond. The question now was, where was it going? Ancient historians cannot agree on where Alexander himself wanted to be buried, but that is perhaps hardly surprising when his heirs couldn't agree either, though each would claim he was doing Alexander's will. The traditional burial place for a king of Macedon was the ancient capital of Lower Macedonia, Ai, on the slopes of the Pierian Mountains in what is now northern Greece. Here, by the modern village of Vergina, lie the remains of a great Macedonian palace whose veranda once commanded a majestic view of the plains of the Haliakmon River, and where, among the ruins of the Temple of Euclea, can still be found the bases of 2 votive statues dedicated by Alexander's grandmother, Queen Eurydice. All around, among the elm trees, can be seen the memorials of ancient Macedonians of all classes and levels of fame, right up to the magnificent royal tombs of the great Tumulus, whose contents are now impressively housed in their own subterranean museum. Here lie the finds from the Tomb of Philip II, discovered in 1977, perhaps the last resting place of Alexander's father. although more recent archaeological work suggests that perhaps it is the tomb of his simple half-brother, Philip III Aridaeus. But whoever the occupant actually was, this was clearly the last resting place of Alexander's ancestors, and hence, perhaps, as close as this restless soul might have come to a final home. But other thoughts had crowded into Alexander's mind in his last years. The trip to Siwa had given him alternative and far more illustrious ancestors, the gods of Egypt. While we do not know to what degree Alexander actually believed that he was a god, Diodorus says his last wish was to be buried not with his earthly ancestors in Ai, but at Siwa, where he could be with his divine father, Amun. But with Alexander dead, there were considerations far greater than his dying wishes. Indeed, all his last wishes were soon forgotten. Whatever he believed or wanted his people to believe, the mummified contents of his golden coffin were worth as much as the coffin itself, literally its weight in gold, wherever it finally ended up. After the procession left Babylon, that body was nominally under the control of Philip III Aridaeus, but as such it must, in truth, have been under the control of Perdiccas. Perdiccas, one of Alexander's faithful bodyguards, had, according to some ancient sources, been given Alexander's ring on his deathbed, as close as the great man came to nominating an heir. Since then he had done his best to try to hold the whole of his old master's dream together, to keep the empire as one entity. Of course he was not ruling in his own right, merely as regent for the dead king's simple half-brother and infant son. But he was certainly in control. So we must imagine that the procession struck out for Ai in lands directly ruled by the people over whom Perdiccas had control. But they would not stay that way for long. Ptolemy was clearly tipped off about the removal of Alexander's body, and he acted quickly. As the funerary cortege wound its way across Asia Minor, back toward Macedon, Ptolemy struck, possibly in or near Damascus. Seizing control of the somber procession, he ordered it to turn south, down the Mediterranean coast, and across Sinai into Egypt. Alexander wasn't going home to Macedon. He was going back to the city he'd founded by the island of Pharos, and there, though dead, he was going to found a new empire, not a crude military conquest, but an empire of the mind. The kidnapping of the body of Alexander was Ptolemy's masterstroke. While the other generals still jostled for wealth and position in the Near East and Persia, he had realized that the one treasure still worth having was the body of the king himself. Ptolemy had decided that Alexander would quite literally be the centerpiece of the new Egyptian empire he planned to rule, and where better to rule from than the city his old master and friend had founded. But again, patience was necessary. Alexandria was not yet a thriving city, and Egypt was not yet so pliable that its people would accept anything their satrap ordered. Ptolemy needed the Egyptians to believe in him and what he stood for. He knew dangerous times were coming. Having stolen the body of Alexander, he had finally severed his links with Perdiccas, showing clearly that he had no belief in the maintenance of Alexander's empire as one coherent entity. He had effectively shouted, "Every man for himself!" and must have known that Perdiccas would now come after him and the treasure he had taken for his own. Egyptian protocols now had to be carefully followed. After a sweltering journey across Sinai, Ptolemy ordered that the body first be taken to the old pharaonic capital of Memphis, 12 miles south of the modern Egyptian capital of Cairo, and interred in an Egyptian-style tomb near his divine father, Amun, while work on both his Alexandrian tomb and his city progressed.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.